This is Dr. Mobeen Sayed with one more episode of Long Story Short with Dr. Bean from the FLCCC platform. The discussion today is really interesting. This is the discussion for the patients who complained of burning sensation in the body, pins and needles, buzzing sensation in the body after long COVID or vaccine injury. There are many pathologies, possible pathologies for this. For example, small fiber neuropathy or the local inflammation in the peripheral areas. However, sensory ganglia are also something that are important to keep an eye on. And we have not talked about sensory ganglions and their pathologies throughout this whole course even once. So today we're going to talk about that. So references first, this is flccc.net or covid19criticalcare.com. You have various treatment protocols, medical evidence, resources, educational events. And if you go to Dr. Bean over here, you would see my lectures as well. As I had said before last time as well, I think for long COVID and or vaccine injury, this is one of the most comprehensive set of video talks that cover management, pathophysiologies, labs, and potential areas to consider. So with this, now let's look at some of these references that I'm going to be using in my diagrams today. This is a study, Neuropathic Pain Associated with COVID-19, a systematic review of case reports. So in this study, they talk about what is neuropathic pain. We'll talk about that as well. But what is important, what I want to show you here is inflammation of the peripheral nerves and ganglia, as well as tissue damage, causes the development of pain. So I'm going to explain what ganglia are, but just have a look at the word used in these studies. So once again, inflammation of the peripheral nerves and ganglia, as well as tissue damage, causes the development of pain. Then if you see here, this is another paper which is brilliant. Functional Anatomy of the Sensory Nervous System, Updates on the Neuroscience Bench. So in this one, there is a specific paragraph that I want to actually explain to you. So here is that paragraph, and I'm going to explain in my drawings. Then this is another very important study, Tissue Resident M2 macrophages directly contact primary sensory neurons in the sensory ganglia after nerve injury. So once again, if you see here, M2 macrophages directly contact primary sensory neurons in the sensory ganglia. This study actually shows that M2 are anti-inflammatory type or non-inflammatory macrophages, and they may actually extend protection to the neurons that are at risk of damage. Then this is a study, SARS-CoV-2 airway infection results in development of somatosensory abnormalities in a hamster model, and we would use some of the information from here as well. Then this study is really important, neuropathic symptoms with SARS-CoV-2 vaccination, and if I just very quickly search for the word ganglia here, this is important. Let's just look at this pathophysiology right now, and then we'll go to my diagrams. All our patients had neuropathic symptoms, but objective findings of small fiber neuropathy were present in a few patients only. What they're saying is every patient included in the study had neuropathic pains, but not everybody had small fiber neuropathy. So what else was going on? So they say not all patients with autonomic dysfunction had abnormalities on skin biopsy. So this is skin biopsies are done to kind of figure out if there's a problem with the nerves, because nerves are under the skin and supplying the skin as well. In studies of mouse, sensory ganglia, small fiber neurons preferentially display the ACE2 docking protein for SARS-CoV-2. So in the sensory ganglia, again, I have not explained what is a sensory ganglia. I would explain that. But in those sensory ganglia, the ACE2 receptors are present on the neuronal cell bodies, and they can dock with the SARS-CoV-2 protein and have that inflammatory reaction. But now the question is, can this happen with the vaccine as well? And here they are explaining this. Small fiber neurons preferentially display the ACE2 docking proteins for SARS-CoV-2 consistent with potential predominance of SFN. Since all SARS-CoV-2 vaccines encode the spike protein, anti-spike protein immune response may link post-COVID and post-vaccine syndromes. Although the spike protein might interact directly with neurons to mediate the sensory symptoms, anti-idiotypic antibodies to the spike protein immune complexes also bind to the ACE2 receptor. And this one part, anti-idiotypical antibodies, we have been talking about it for 2 years now. That what happens is that there are antibodies that are produced against, let's say, spike protein, and then our body would produce another set of antibodies that are against this antibody. And this other set is called anti-idiotypical antibodies. Their job is to clear out any free-floating antibodies against a spike protein. So this other anti-idiotypical antibody is actually an image of the spike protein because it needs to bind with this other antibody. And because it has a binding region that looks like spike protein's part, it can bind with ACE2 as well and cause ACE2 issues. Very important thing to keep in mind. So although the spike protein might interact directly with neurons to mediate the sensory symptoms, anti-idiotypic antibodies to the spike protein immune complexes also bind to the ACE2 receptors. Dysautonomia during and after SARS-CoV-2 infection is similar but more severe in acutely ill COVID-19 patients and post-COVID-19 patients than in this post-vaccination series. So that's what they observed. So this is another very important study to look at. Then, how is peripheral injury signaled to satellite glial cells in sensory ganglia? And I would explain that. Then, neuron-associated macrophage proliferation in the sensory ganglia is associated with peripheral nerve injury-induced neuropathic pain involving CX3-CR1 signaling. Finally, another very comprehensive article about neuropathic pains. And one solution is to give anti-ILF3 drugs. ILF3, or interleukin enhancer binding factor 3, is an enzyme present in our cells whose job is to help ribosomes. Ribosomes are tiny little machineries that bind with messenger RNA and they make proteins. This ILF3 helps the messenger RNA bind with the ribosome. So it helps with the elongation of the protein that is being made. And it has been seen that anti-ILF3 drugs can reduce the production of these proteins. And this was tested in sensory ganglion damage in mice model, where these drugs actually help protect the neurons and reverse or control the ganglionic damage. So there is a possible solution here as well with already approved drugs. So with these references, let's now go to my diagrams. So first of all, what is neuropathic pain? The International Association of the Study of Pain defines neuropathic pain as pain caused by a lesion or disease of somatosensory nervous system. Soma is our body. The whole thing is our body, but we will say the parts of the body that we can voluntarily control, muscles, bones, skin. Skin we don't control, but still is part of soma. Somatosensory means the sensory system that is taking sensory information from the soma, from the body to the brain, spinal cord and the brain. This definition replaces an older definition according to which neuropathic pain was pain initiated or caused by a primary lesion, dysfunction, or transitory perturbation of the peripheral or central nervous system. Now, the central nervous system is brain, brainstem, which is part of the brain, and spinal cord. Peripheral nervous system is all those nerves that come out of these structures and then they go into the body, which also includes autonomic nervous system nerves as well, and sympathetic system and parasympathetic system. This was the older definition. Two changes are important in this change of definition. Remember, the new definition is neuropathic pain as pain caused by lesion or disease of the somatosensory nervous system. So what are the two changes? Number one, dysfunction and the neuronal lesion. These two words are removed. Dysfunction is no longer accepted as a criteria because it is difficult to accept symptoms and soft signs as criteria if they cannot be verified objectively. In addition, it is now specified that the lesion needs to affect the somatosensory system, meaning the lesions or diseases outside of the somatosensory system, for example, cerebellum. So cerebellum is a structure over here below the brain, and that is not connected with the somatosensory system. It is just a system sitting separately and helping the brain do its function. So if there is a lesion of the cerebellum, it is not considered, and if there is pain because of that, that is not neuropathic pain. Although they say that maybe in the future definition, this would change. Okay, so I want to continue, and this is something that we have to focus on today. What we have over here is a spinal cord illustration. The spinal cord has a collection of nerve cell bodies in it, which is called gray matter of the spinal cord. Then the nerve, so if I can quickly, this is a neuron cell. However, neuronal cells are not just simple round or cuboidal or elongated cells. They actually have neurites attached with them. Neurites are actually the fibers attached to them. So usually neurons have one long fiber called an axon. And in the majority of the neurons, these axons are further myelinated for performance and energy conservation. Then neurons also have tiny, smaller structures, which are also neurites, and these are called dendrites. So the neuronal cell body, wherever it is present, that area is given a specific name. For example, here in the spinal cord, the gray matter is actually the neuronal cell bodies. So of course, the neurons have their axons as well, or the neurites as well. In case of, for example, motor neurons, so if I wanted to move my fingers and I can move them, what is happening is the brain is sending messages to the spinal cord, and then from the spinal cord, a neuron who has a cell body here in the gray matter, and the axon comes out and goes to the muscle, that will be a motor neuron. The cell body is present here. So this gray matter is made up of many such cell bodies. Similarly, if you look at our brain, the brain's structure, if you look at that structure histologically, it is also divided into gray matter and white matter. Most of the time, if I have a lot of neurons, cell bodies here, and you see them under a microscope, they would appear gray, and so we call them gray matter, which is a collection of neuronal cell bodies. And they have these axons coming out of them, the neurites. These axons are myelinated as well, majority of them. And so when you look at this part where these threads are coming and going, that would look white. So we call it white matter. So normally white matter is the axons traveling in that area. Now, let's actually finish the discussion of what is sensory ganglia, etc. So here, gray matter within the central nervous system, that is brain, brainstem, and the spinal cord, any collection of neuronal cell bodies in the form of a sheet are gray matters. However, it is possible that there are some neurons that are present, you know, just randomly interspersed in these axonal pathways. And if you look at this area, if you look at a section under the microscope, this area would look like it has a dotty appearance. Wherever these neuronal cell bodies are, you would see these black dots, and wherever these are not present, you would see these fibers passing, and these would look white areas. So we call this reticular formation. Reticular formation is the dotty appearance of intermixed fibers and neuronal cell bodies, but these cell bodies have not clustered together. They're kind of spread out. Then within our brain stem, still within these fibers that are passing, there are actually clusters of neuron cell bodies that don't make a sheet-like structure. They're just one cluster together, and they also have their fibers. Such clusters within the central nervous system of the neuronal bodies are called nuclei. So the cranial nerve nuclei, for example, or vital center nuclei. In the spinal cord as well, we have collections of neuronal cell bodies that will be called gray matter. So now we know gray matter, reticular formation, and the nuclei. Finally, it is actually possible, especially for the sensory system and even autonomic nervous system, especially sympathetic nervous system, that the neuronal cell bodies are present outside of the central nervous system. So here is a neuronal cell body present outside, and its axon is connecting it to the spinal cord. And the other side is connecting it to some structure, for example, skin or the muscle or bone or tendon. This is a sensory neuron. Its cell body is not present in the central nervous system. It is present outside. And where it is present, there are many other neuronal cell bodies present in this area as well. This collection of neuron cell bodies outside of the central nervous system is called a ganglion. And we have sensory ganglion. What that means is that these neurons here are connected with the sensory pathways. We have autonomic ganglions, for example, sympathetic ganglions. They are connected with the sympathetic nervous system functions, etc. So today's whole discussion is about this ganglion. So I'm going to develop this ganglion layer by layer. So first of all, this ganglion has this neuronal cell body that is a main actor here. Neuronal cell body has an axon that comes out of it and then bifurcates into a peripheral process that goes and connects with skin, muscle, tendon, bone, etc. And then a central process which goes and connects into the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. We don't call it posterior, we call it dorsal, but the back side of the spinal cord. This sensory neuron could be myelinated or unmyelinated. For example, slow pain fibers are not myelinated. On the other hand, fast tactile fibers, for example, touch, pressure, vibration, two-point discrimination, are myelinated. Now, there is another important thing to consider, especially for the pain nerves, that their endings, their receptor area, is a free nerve ending. If I can make it big enough, this is a free nerve ending, just a big blob. So if I said, what is a ganglion? I think your answer will be collection of the nerve cell bodies outside of the nervous system. This ganglion can be sensory if it is for the sensory nerves, or autonomic if it is, for example, sympathetic nerves. Of course, the neuron cell body will be called soma, and then this fiber is called the axon. Now, there are many descriptions of this because the question is it two fibers or is it one fiber? So the consensus is that this is one fiber that has developed into a T-like structure and divided into two, one peripheral part and one central part. And so this is one axon which has this behavior of bifurcating and connecting with the neuronal cell body. This is why this neuronal cell body is called pseudo-unipolar neuron. That is, it actually has two poles, but they look like one pole coming out of one side of the neuron. There is literature where the peripheral process is called a dendrite and the central process is called an axon, or the other way around. I'm just going to take the most commonly used definition, that this whole thing is an axon and it has this bifurcation here. So, few important things. This neuron cell body can release glutamate, release glutamate on the central process. It can release glutamate neurotransmitter, which can then affect its own central process. So that is how the neuron can actually modulate the nerve impulses that are passing through the system. Now, it is interesting that the nerve impulses in the other neurons will actually go, let's say, from axon to the neuronal cell body. From there, it would then be further moved through the dendrites. So the neuronal cell body actually takes part in that travel of the nerve impulse. But here, or the signal, right? But here, the impulses are coming from the periphery and they're just directly going to the center. Neuronal cell body does not come in that functional process. However, this neuronal cell body can modulate what is happening here. So by, for example, releasing glutamate. Similarly, it can also release GABA, and GABAergic neurotransmitters can actually modulate or try to reduce the impulses that are passing from here. Now, next layer. This is a very important concept. For this concept, if we can also understand a tiny bit about blood-brain barrier, not exhaustive, just a quick understanding. What happens is that when we have any tissue, for example, let's say muscle, the tissues have blood supply coming to them. So the blood vessel arrives and then breaks down into smaller and smaller branches. And these smaller branches become capillaries. So if you look at those capillaries, you would see that the capillaries have endothelial cells. All blood vessels have them. And these endothelial cells are placed in a way to leave tiny gaps between them, very thin microscopic gaps between them. These gaps allow substances to move out and move back into the capillary, right? So this is the normal capillary structure for normal tissues. Brain or central nervous system does not take this risk that whatever is in the blood vessel somehow has an opportunity to come in contact with the neuronal cell bodies and the neuronal tissue present in the central nervous system. So what happens is that in the case of blood-brain barrier, we do have these capillaries over there as well, but these endothelial cells are present, tightly pressed against each other. We call it tight junctions between them. And so there is no place, there is no gap between them through which the products that are present in the blood circulation can come out. That cannot happen because the cells are just tightly pressed against each other. So then the question is, how will the nutrition and glucose and other products come out? These cells in the brain capillaries, they have channels on them which will pick up the substances of interest for the neuronal tissues and bring them out of the blood system. So there are channels for this. This is how controlled it is. But the story doesn't finish here. Even after providing this control, bodies still do not believe that this is sufficient to protect the brain. So then we have another set of cells that are wrapping around these capillary cells are called pericytes. So now that means that when there is any fluid or any substance coming out of the blood system through these channels, that substance is still not touching or arriving in the neuronal tissue because it just ended up in a space that is enveloped by pericytes. So how would that come out from there, those substances? Well, pericytes also have channels in them to then once again make sure that whatever is necessary to be brought out, only that comes out and not everything. But even that is not sufficient. Our body still is not comforted that, hey, this is good enough protection. We have another set of cells called astrocytes. Astrocytes are called astrocytes because they have star-like branches on them. And these branches have swollen ends, which are called foot processes. So astrocytes will then send foot processes that would also wrap around the pericytes and create another layer of protection. So then whatever is in the pericyte and as between the pericyte and astrocyte, whatever is out here, how would that go to the neuronal tissue? Well, astrocytes also have channels to then decide what goes out of here. And then comes the neuronal tissue where these things can go. But the story still does not finish there. There is another set of cells, the monocytes, that are standing here outside in case anything bad comes out. And they would try to protect and they would try to take care of it. This is how intense the control is to make this blood-brain barrier or provided by this blood-brain barrier to protect this neuronal tissue. So you would probably suspect that a similar control will be offered for those poor neurons that are sitting outside in the ganglions. But that is where the whole story becomes very different. So what happens is, in the ganglions, then there is another layer of cells called satellite glial cells. Glial cells are present in the brain as well. And their job is to, they do support work, plus they provide other, they make other cells as well that takes care of the defense and support and nutrition of the brain tissues. Glial cells kind of have a stem cell-like behavior that they can make their own kind, they can replenish themselves, and they can make other kind of cells as well. In the ganglion, sensory ganglion, for example, the glial cells that are present here will be called satellite glial cells because they're away from the central nervous system. They're sitting outside. However, these glial cells have a behavior that these cells make sure that as they are surrounding the neurons, neuron cell bodies, they leave gaps between them so that things, substances can pass between the glial cells and come in contact with the neurons, neuron cell bodies. So here, instead of protecting the neurons, we are actually designing a system that allows substances that would be present in the environment here to actually connect with the cell bodies of the neurons. Story doesn't finish there. Of course, the sensory ganglion or ganglions, they have blood supply as well. It is interesting. You would probably suspect that, hey, looking at the blood-brain barrier, this blood supply would also have similar structure or similar protections, and the blood vessels are kind of closed and they have channels to allow only important things to come out and non-toxic things to come out. But these blood vessels have a very strange behavior, and that is that some part of these blood vessels is continuous wall. That means they look like blood-brain barrier-like fused cells, but then the other parts of the same blood vessels have holes in them. Not just little tiny little gap, they have holes in the cells. We call them collectively as fenestrations. These holes actually allow the large molecules from the blood to come out and bathe this whole environment. And of course, the glial cells that were surrounding the neurons to protect them, these cells are also leaving gaps between them. So whatever comes out of the blood and would come out easily because there are holes in the blood vessels, these are fenestrated, that substance would then pass through the glial cells and come in contact with the neuronal cell body. So it seems like the body's design system is making an attempt that whatever is in the blood circulation, macromolecules, neurotransmitters, toxins, they can come out of the blood circulation and connect with the neuronal cell bodies. This should make it very clear that sensory ganglions or sympathetic ganglions as well are prone to becoming affected by macromolecules, neurotransmitters, messengers, toxins, drugs present in the blood circulation, and they would affect these cells. The story doesn't just finish there. We have to add one more set of cells. So let's go to the next diagram. Here, if you see these little cells, these are macrophages. These sensory ganglions also have immune system cells in there too, to help with the current, you know, needs of the tissue. So macrophages and dendritic cells are present there as well. These macrophages can be in M1 state, which is pro-inflammatory state, or M2 state, depending upon the need of the function that they need to offer. And if they're M1, they would be pro-inflammatory, and their inflammatory molecules would affect the neuron cell body. And if they're M2 state, then they would provide protection to kind of prevent the neuron from dying. Now, here is another important concept to keep in mind. These macrophages can proliferate, that is, increase in number. Not only they can actually proliferate, they can increase in volume as well. And this debate has been going on for ages to say, is it those extra macrophages here? Are these macrophages actually coming in from the blood circulation and they are kind of coming out of the blood and becoming residents here? Because whenever there is sensory neuron damage, or whenever there is inflammation in the sensory ganglion, these cells increase in number. So the debate continues that, hey, where do they come from? And it turns out that they can actually come in from the blood circulation. When there is a inflammation or injury to the neuron, then about 7 days later, there are going to be macrophages that would arrive from the blood circulation and enter this area. However, the number of macrophages would start increasing soon after the injury, even to the peripheral part of the neuronal cell axon. That happens because an injured nerve releases messages here that cause these macrophages to become proliferated. So the existing macrophages increase in number because of the injury signals coming from the neuronal cell bodies. They would in turn either become M2 and try to protect the neurons, or if they become M1, they would release even more inflammatory molecules, causing even more damage. Another interesting thing about the sensory ganglion, these glial cells, they are bipotent. Bipotent means they have two kinds of potencies. They can replenish themselves, that is one potency they have, and they can give rise to new sensory cells. That is their bipotency, the second potency. So in the mice model, the glial cells actually give rise to new sensory cells when the previous sensory cells are damaged. So let's just back up for a second and understand what's going on. The sensory ganglion are the neuronal cell bodies present outside of the central nervous system. We thought that maybe they would be given the same protection as the blood-brain barrier gives the protection to the central nervous system tissue. But instead, the structures here are designed in a way that the system, our body, goes out of its way to expose the neurons here to the products, macromolecules, toxins, drugs, neurotransmitters present in the circulation. Not only that, there are macrophages that would proliferate, and their effect can also cause the neurons to be affected. Now the question is, what happens to the neuron? Not only it is to protect the neuron or to cause the neuron to become inflamed based on the inflammatory molecules, the neuron can actually become, it can misfire. Under the influence of all these things here, the neuron can possibly fire from here. This firing, this creation of a nerve signal from here, is a classic example of neuropathic pain, because neuropathic pain excludes the pain that is generated by the pain fibers. So if you crush your finger, there are pain receptors there, free nerve endings, that would create the feeling of pain. That is not called neuropathic pain. That is pain. But if there is an injury, a lesion of the nervous system here, somatosensory nervous system, that is called neuropathic pain. So when the sensory ganglion's neuron in there, they misfire and they generate a signal aberrantly which would then go to brain and create the sense of paresthesia. Paresthesia means abnormal sensation, tingling, crawling, burning sensation, or allodynia. Allodynia means is a sensory input that should not be painful becomes painful. For example, if somebody has a burnt skin, you know, type 1 burn, and if you touch there, the touch should not normally produce pain, but now it will produce pain. That is called allodynia. Or hyperesthesia. Hyperesthesia is a painful stimulus would be more painful than it should be. That happens because of excitability of the neuronal tissue. So this ganglionic damage or inflammatory state of the ganglion can cause production of signals that could be painful, that could be paresthesias, this could be allodynias, hyperesthesias. But the story doesn't just finish there. When this neuron fires, we will call it ectopic signal. When that ectopic signal is produced, and that signal travels towards the center to the spinal cord, then from there to the brain, there is a signal which is orthograde. So this is called centripetal signal, and this is called centrifugal signal, or orthograde and retrograde. So the centripetal signal will go to the brain. The centrifugal signal from the neuronal cell body will travel towards the receptor site. Now that is a problem. Why? Because the sensory system is used to bringing signals from the receptor area towards the center. And here we are sending a signal in the axon towards the periphery. What that does is, especially in the case of pain nerve fibers, remember we discussed that the pain nerve fibers have free nerve endings at their end. So when the signal arrives in this area, in the free nerve ending area, free nerve ending can release substance P and CGRP. I had to do a lot of research to pull this whole set of content together. So free nerve endings, when they receive impulses towards them, they can then release under that influence substance P and CGRP. Substance P and CGRP in turn cause the local blood vessels to kind of swell up and develop gaps between them to allow fluids to ooze out, to spill out, and substances to spill out and cause local congestion. When the fluids accumulate in some tissue where they should not, we call it congestion. And of course, with the congestion, there will be swelling as well and there will be redness as well. But that is not all. These two substances would cause local immune cells like macrophages and dendritic cells to become activated as well. Now, a macrophage, when it becomes active, it doesn't really know at this time. It is already active. It doesn't know that I should not have been active. There is no injury here. It received the message to become active. It became active. When it became active, this macrophage is going to now start releasing inflammatory molecules and a whole war is going to start here. This tissue was actually not in any problems. There was no pathology here. But because of the signal coming from the neuronal cell body, now we have inflammation here. So imagine for a second that this nerve was connected to our toe. Of course, there are thousands of nerves there, but let's just assume one nerve was connected to the toe. And this signal from the sensory ganglion was traveling towards that. Guess what will happen? The toe of the person will swell up. It will become inflamed, it will become red, and it would have the local macrophages active. And now the patient and the doctor are going to be looking at this place to say, what is wrong here? They will be doing skin biopsies here to say, what is wrong with the nerve here? Guess what? They might find some inflammation there, but they would not find any problems with the nerve because the problem is here. And this can happen, as I showed you in the references before, this can happen because of COVID or because of vaccine through anti-idiotypical antibodies plus the inflammatory molecules spilling into this area. And then increase in number of glial cells, macrophages, and there is also a possibility that the neuron will have its genes transcribed differently. And this neuron might become excitable in the long run, and a chronic pain would develop. Not only that can happen, this neuron might start developing more and more sodium channels on it, which will make it more, we call it facilitation. The neuron will become facilitated. It is easy to excite, and the synapses will become facilitated. The impulses would be easy to travel. So we have a problem. So I want to read this to you, which kind of sums up what I just explained. And I have already earlier shown you the study from where it comes. That study is Functional Anatomy of the Sensory Nervous System. So in here, this is the area which I have here. The sheath formed by satellite glial cells surround the sensory neuron cell body, but is not continuous. Rather, it contains interspaced gaps that allow the penetration of dye tracer, neurotransmitters, and other macromolecules. Similarly, sensory ganglion blood vessels are lined by a mixture of continuous and fenestrated endothelium that also allows extravasation of dye tracers and macromolecules. As a consequence, unlike central nervous system neurons that sit within the blood-brain barrier, sensory neuron cell bodies lack a barrier to the circulation. These structural features make it likely that sensory neurons are readily exposed to inflammatory mediators, systemic drugs, or toxins present in the systemic circulation, perhaps more so than many other organs in the body. And what will happen to the patient if you go over? I do not have sufficient time to go over each one of these studies that I have placed here, but you would see that the patient would feel burning sensation in the body, tingling, crawling, swelling of the under the skin, or marbling of the blood under the skin because of the blood extravasation or the fluids extravasation, not blood, from these swollen capillaries. And there is actually no problem under the skin. The nerves are fine. It is a sensory ganglion that is under attack. And then sensory ganglion has more macrophages now, more glial cells now. There are even transcriptional changes that happen in the I want to quickly show you this. Infection is a developmental somatosensory. I think this is the one. So if you see here, 31 days after infection, a neuropathic transcriptome emerged in the thoracic dorsal root ganglion from SARS-CoV-2 infected animals, which coincide with SARS-CoV-2 specific mechanical hypersensitivity. So not only there are inflammatory effects, but neuron actually becomes different and becomes more chronically excitable and causing these paresthesias and hyperesthesias. So in this study, Serfini's study, they finally proposed the blockers for ILF3. Because once they use those blockers in the animal model, the sensory ganglion's pathologies start recovering. So this is the discussion. Thank you very much. A little more complex than normal discussions, but it is really important for us to understand, especially the providers, that it is not just the nerve or skin issue. It could be a sensory ganglion issue that is then causing sensory paresthesias, pain signals, or neuropathic pain. Plus, they're causing pathological changes in the physical body where there was actually no injury because of substance P and CGRP release in those areas. So this is the discussion. Thank you very much. And we will continue with this series to dig deeper into some of the studies later on. Bye for now.